welcome to Music at Menlo Audio Notes. I'm your host, Nikki Sweat. On Thursday, August 4th, violinist Bella Hristova and pianist Shai Wozner team up to perform music of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart and David Serkin Ludwig. This is the only concert this season that does not include music by Joseph Haydn. Yet, in Mozart's writing, we can hear so many echoes of what Haydn did. Haydn didn't explore much the potential of piano and violin, and so we might think of Mozart's creations for this instrumentation as bringing some of the spirit and innovation of Haydn's style to a new genre. The program opens and closes with sonatas for piano and violin by Mozart, but at the heart of the concert are two fantasies. First, David Ludwig's Swan Song, which takes us on a varied journey inspired by Franz Schubert's great fantasy for violin and piano. And then, a performance of musicologist Robert Levin's recent reconstruction of Mozart's dramatic fantasy in C minor. Shai Wozner spoke with me about the first number on the program, Mozart's 1781 Sonata in F Major, K377.
The Mozart violin sonatas, the first 12 are actually two groups of six. They were published as Opus 1, the first six, and then Opus 2, the second set of six. And this one is the middle of the second set. It was dedicated to a noblewoman, Josefa von Auernhammer. And so sometimes the sonatas are called the Auernhammer sonatas. And this is from the period in Salzburg. You know, you get this sense of Mozart really growing and developing as a composer, which I know it's a little silly to say that because, you know, one of the greatest composers of all time. And yet it's so fascinating to see where he starts off and the early mature pieces, the mastery and that spark of inspiration that kind of seems to glow over the whole piece is all of a sudden found in pieces from that period. For me, this sonata is very much in that vein. You feel the spark of genius from beginning to end, and it's some sort of a departure from the earlier Mozart, which even though it's brilliant and it's really wonderful, it's not quite the same thing. But this is something else, and you notice that from the very beginning, the very first movement, which is quite unusual. Does have this perpetual motion, which is not common for the style of the time. It's more common for Baroque style to have this constant rolling rhythm, 16th notes, or in this case triplets, you know, it keeps going. But rather than sounding Baroque, I think this movement sounds very operatic. The theme is introduced in the piano, and the violin has the triplets. But then they flip. And then the triplets go to the piano, and the violin takes over. So by avoiding having the same instrument play the triplets all the time, he's really energize, he energizes the movement even more and adds a sense of drama because they alternate parts and they compete with each other and they complement each other. And it's really a sense, more a sense of dialogue rather than sort of a monologue in one of the instruments with the other one accompanying. And of course, the triplet in the violin are written in such a way that's very idiomatic for the instrument. So they're repeated notes. Every beat has three of the same note, which on the piano would be very awkward and not very pianistic. When they switch to the piano, they're more arpeggiated. They're so they go up and down more, and therefore, even though it's the same rhythm, the texture is different. Another way that he adds variety is by adding counter ideas. So let's say you have a fast figuration in the triplets going up, the left hand would have a more jagged counter idea. While above it, there is this, you know, these waves of triplets. So it's really more varied than it sounds at first. So he's really able to have it both ways. The constant rush of the triplets and still a huge variety of ideas and textures. That movement, the second movement, has a whiff of Baroque to it, I think. The series of variations, you know, the theme is very simple, and yet it kind of, it almost demands to just be repeated over and over again. Kind of like in a passacaglia, you know, the Baroque genre, you would have a ground bass, a pattern in the bass that would continue, you know, repeating, and then variations building on top of it. So for a set of variations, it's pretty simple. In other words, he doesn't depart very far from the theme, except the moment where he goes into major, which is, of course, very special. And then in the end, you have a Sicilian rhythm, the tam padam pam padam pam padam, you know, which also makes it sound quite Baroque-like. The last movement is quite unusual in its own way. This movement very, very special. It belongs in a very exclusive club of last movements in F major in 3/4 time that are not virtuosic or brilliant, but rather very serene, angelic, and almost otherworldly. There's something to it that is very, is totally elsewhere from the rest of the sonata. It's like you went up to heaven and you just stayed there, and then the piece ends. You never come back. He wasn't bothered with big splashy endings. You know, they were thinking it's not romantic, the romantic notion of the concert experience where you must have a big, fast and loud ending. And add to that the nature of the theme itself, which is full of rests. And he uses the rests throughout the movement to give the movement this sort of sense of restraint. Ending is very touching and very intimate, and it's really not what you thought when you first heard the sonata open. Like at the beginning of the sonata, you think, oh, this is going to be a mad dash and, you know, of energy, and then the piece takes you somewhere else entirely.
The second work on this program, Swan Song for Violin and Piano, written in 2013 by the American composer David Serkin Ludwig, opens with a swirl of notes that Mozart likely wouldn't have seen as a possibility. Yet Ludwig's writing is never entirely removed from the musical languages of the past. This piece in particular was in part inspired by the fantasy in C major for violin and piano, written by Franz Schubert in 1827. I spoke with Bella Hristova, together with David, who happens to be her husband, about that Schubert fantasy, about his motivations and methods when writing this piece, and about the experience of performing it.
Yeah, I find everything beautiful and inspiring about Schubert, and he's my favorite composer. Schubert is a composer I've spent my whole life with. I remember as a teenager reading Schubert biographies and him really appealing to my more kind of emo side. And just, you know, the songs, the chamber music, of course the orchestra work, but for me, and with my background, the chamber music especially has been very meaningful. And so later in life, I came across a recording of my grandfather and great-grandfather playing the fantasy. Mm-hmm. And just thinking about that opening texture and that sound really made me want to do something similar as well and try to capture that ineffable moment. You know, there is a moment in the piece where Schubert is quoted directly. I say to audiences when the piece is played that Schubert's ghost briefly walks across the stage. It's a broader thing, the idea of a fantasy, the idea of kind of kaleidoscopic changes and that every turn kind of brings you to a new place. But there's a lot of Schubert's textures and kind of more romantic leanings into the piece and a virtuosity that's maybe a little different than Schubert's, but it's more about the sounds and the vibe, I think, as the kids would say.
I have played Swan Song a number of times before, though it was not written for me, but I think all music that I play sort of feeds off of each other. So even though I'm not actively thinking about the Schubert fantasy when I play Swan Song, there is that one point where Schubert's ghost, as David said, walks across the stage, and it's a very brief appearance.
Do you get scared then, or
I don't get scared. Okay, actually, I love that part, and I love how he comes out of it. It sort of evaporates into thin air. If you break down all music, it's scales and arpeggios, right? But then it's what the composer does with it. I think there are many of the same techniques that Schubert uses, David also uses, and there are lyrical sections. There are some very physical and technically demanding sections. There are some gorgeous ethereal sections, and that's how the piece starts too. So it's all there. It's just through a 21st century lens, if you will. Well, whenever David writes aleatory, I'm just not comfortable being that spontaneous on stage. You know, I'm very comfortable being musically spontaneous on stage, but when it comes to not knowing what notes I'm going to play and in what order, it's just not something I have a lot of experience with. So whenever David writes sort of ad libitum passages where you play, I think he says downward run, avoid scales, avoid patterns. I'll usually write down something in my music that I can then practice that appears random, but to me it's not.
You're giving away all the secrets.
Well, I gotta. That's just how I deal with it. I think other people are very comfortable improvising on stage. And I admire that.
Yeah, but I mean, fair enough, because I think performers spend their whole lives, like actors, learning how to reproduce lines and how to interpret lines given and not... You play Beethoven, you're not going to change notes. Right. You act in a Shakespeare play, you're not going to be like, to be, or maybe I won't, actually, you know? So I get that. And the accuracy of a performer's performance is actually a starting off point, right? That your technique gives you freedom. On the other hand, aleatory, so this is music where the composer has not actually specified something really specific, but instead, you know, said play these notes in any order, or here's the bottom note, here's the top note, play 15 notes in between that you choose, you know, this kind of thing. That's aleatory. And the word comes from, I think it's the Greek word for dice, like rolling dice, alia. So, but for me, I'm really interested in the kind of blurry lines between abstraction and something syntactical, something, you know, that's both abstract and realist at the same time, and putting those together. So often, you know, the violin might be doing something a little more improvisatory, but the piano is holding a beat and is holding something, you know, that's very, very tenable, that you can hold on to. So that space, that kind of gray space, is really interesting to me. Fantasy is an interesting form because it's what composers call their piece when they have no idea what else to call it, you know. That it's, you're taken through this narrative, and it's not that things don't repeat. I mean, things do repeat, and they need to repeat to be intelligible, to communicate it, an actual narrative, and point A to B and C and back to A. But it doesn't follow a kind of traditional set path. There's something fun about it. You're constantly exploring new places and new territories in the process of the journey.
The second half of this concert program opens with a 1782 fantasy in C minor for piano and violin that Mozart left unfinished. A version for solo piano was posthumously completed by Mozart's friend Maximilian Stadler and has been a popular standalone concert work since the 19th century. In 2014, renowned scholar and pianist Robert Levin reconstructed the violin part, allowing the work to be performed for Mozart's original instrumentation. Shai explained what makes this music so worthy of numerous attempts at recomposition.
There is a period in sort of around the middle of Mozart's mature years where he left quite a few things unfinished. Nobody knows why. And years after his death, his wife and her second husband, she sold the Mozart estate, the archive, if you will, all the manuscripts to a publisher. And she also wanted the unfinished stuff to be completed by someone. She approached a musician by the name of Maximilian Stadler with some of these fragments. And I think he turned down a lot of them because he thought he doesn't want to. He just can't. And yet this one must have appealed to him. Talking about a fragment of 20-something measures, but slow measures, so it's longer than it sounds, about half a movement in Mozart's handwriting for keyboard, for piano, with a few bars towards the end of the fragment, a few bars of accompaniment for violin. He did not call it fantasy, he did not call it anything because it was not finished. It's tempting to think of it as a fantasy because there is a bar in it, in the Mozart original, that is actually not, that deviates from the time signature that he puts in the beginning. All of a sudden, the bar is too long. And so either it's because it's a sketch and he wasn't, you know, he didn't care about details, he was going to maybe straighten it out later on, or maybe he really sees it as a very improvisatory piece that doesn't have to bow to time signature constraints and therefore maybe is a fantasy. So to go back to Stadler, Constanze's composer of choice to complete this fragment, he did complete it as a piano piece. He got rid of the violin part that was in the manuscript, straightened out that bar that's too long, and he, you know, made it conform to the 4/4 time signature, and added the middle section. And then a recapitulation at the end. Musically, the themes and just the writing is really powerful. The idea, the main idea of it, which is quite Baroque-like because it has these flourishes and dotted rhythms that hint, you know, at Baroque influence. It's a very significant, meaningful theme. It's not a frothy sketch. In other words, it makes it even more mysterious. Why did he really not finish this? I mean, he was onto something with this. It's not like it was hitting a dead end. I mean, you know, he got to the end of the section. So it's quite a mystery. The element of dialogue is the single most important element in Mozart's music. I think his greatest contribution to the history of music, if you had to boil it down, is the sense of dialogue. Nobody before Mozart was able to convey the subtleties of dialogue between, and dialogue is not necessarily just between two characters in an opera, but just the dialogue or, you know, back and forth between two contrasting ideas or two contrasting characters in the music, even if it's wordless music. And so in other words, he's a great opera composer because of that and not vice versa. You know, people think, oh, he's an opera composer and therefore all of his pieces are opera-like. No, all of his pieces have dialogue and inherent in them, and therefore that's why he was such a great opera composer, because it's actually part of his language, even when he doesn't write for voices.
That idea of a rich, contrast-filled dialogue between instrumental voices is crucial to understanding what makes Mozart's 1784 Sonata for Piano and Violin in B-flat major, K-454, a revolutionary piece of music. In this work, Mozart changes the scale and status of this instrumentation in the ways that Haydn did for the string quartet and the symphony, and that Beethoven eventually would for the piano trio, the cello sonata, and so many other kinds of music. Bella and David spoke about the many characters, the surprising turns, and the orchestral qualities that can be found throughout the three movements of Mozart's B-flat major violin sonata.
What's amazing about the three Mozart works that we're playing is that they were written within the three-year span of each other. And if you look at the opus numbers, there's about 100 in between, almost 100 works that he wrote in that three-year period. He wrote the 454 Sonata in 1784, and he would have been, what, 27, 28 at that time. And actually, I think that's right around the time he met Haydn for the first time. But he wrote the sonata for himself, or more accurately, he wrote it to be played with a violinist, a young Italian virtuoso violinist who was visiting Vienna. And he wrote to his father that he was very excited to be writing this new work, which was going to be premiered on Thursday. As it happens, our Carte Blanche concert is also on Thursday. The piece is very virtuosic for both instruments. I do think he kicks it up a notch. And I think part of that was the inspiration of having a great young Italian virtuoso that he was writing for to play with. These sonatas are written for piano and violin. That's in the title. So it's actually the piano is the main instrument. Violin accompaniment, though in this case, the parts are absolutely equal. And it's a showcase of what the instruments could do, but also musically, it's a very mature work. It's quite heartfelt. He starts with two big, very strong statements, which are then contrasted by softer, more melodic statements. To me, it sort of sets up the piece to be a little more orchestral sounding. He's getting a lot out of those two instruments to imitate an orchestra. I think it's a very regal opening, so perhaps that was pay homage to some of the audience members and his patrons. So there are two very strong statements contrasted by sung melodies. It's almost operatic in a way, that opening. to me, the first movement also sounds orchestral. There are some parts, for example, what the piano starts with in the Allegro. To me, that sounds like a bassoon. Later, there are lines of the violin sounds that has that I could hear an oboe playing that. So I think he's trying to set up our ears to listen in a more orchestral way, just to make the genre of the violin piano sonata into a larger work. So the slow movement of the 454 sonata, I think, was probably like nothing that the Viennese audience had heard before. To me, every single note of that movement is extremely heartfelt and full of emotion.
That slow movement, and also in the C minor fantasy, mm-hmm. there's this incredible chromaticism, which is so expressive as he's using notes from outside the scale that really is very special to Mozart, I think, and just so sensitive.
Yeah, he's a genius with how he did all of that. He takes us on a journey through many different keys and characters, and he does it so masterfully that they're not necessarily modulations you expect to hear, but once you hear them, you can't imagine it going anywhere else. There's one moment in the second movement that's my perhaps favorite moment of the sonata, where the violin holds the same note for three measures, except it's heard as the same note, but actually in the music, the third measure has a different note because of how the harmony falls. He takes us on a modulation, and then he takes us to a new key, but then he does a deceptive cadence in that key. And that all happens in the span of just three measures, and the violin soars on top of it. The piano has all the harmonies, and then it blooms into this new key, and then we're there for a while. And I think that's just a magical moment.
That's the thing about Mozart. It's somehow both surprising and inevitable at the same time. Thank you.
next movement is light and joyful, and maybe he felt he had to write that after that gorgeous slow movement, just so that people leave on a light note and a happy note. And he does go places. He goes to dark places, but it always returns to this very positive opening. And, you know, he changes the dynamics, he changes the intensity, but I think our experience when we come back to each time that the Rondo theme comes, it's sort of like a sigh, like, ah, this is nice. Like, we're back to this. At the very end of the piece, he gives the violin a very virtuosic flourish. It's all in triplets. The piece could end there. And then every time I played this, I have to stifle a laughter, because right after those violin triplets, the piano plays in 16th notes. So the piano has to be more virtuosic and it has to outdo the violin. And it's really like a contest. I think he meant it as a joke, and it was like, oh yeah, you can do that. Well, look at what I can do.
Right.
And then the piece ends.
Music at Menlo Audio Notes are written and produced by Nikki Sweat, in consultation with David Finkel and Wu Han. Many thanks to Shai Wozner, Bella Hristova, and David Ludwig for speaking with me on this session. Musical excerpts are courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Mozart's Sonata in F Major, K377, was played by Carl Seemann and Wolfgang Schneiderhan, and can be heard on the album Mozart Violin Sonatas on Deutsche Grammophon. Ludwig's Swan Song was performed by Benjamin Beilman and Yequan Sunwu, courtesy of David Serkin Ludwig. Mozart's Fantasy in C Minor, K396, as arranged for piano by Maximilian Stadler, was performed by Carl Seemann and can be heard on the album Mozart Complete Keyboard Works on the Brilliant Classics label. And Mozart's Sonata in B-flat Major for violin and piano, K454, was played by Bella Hristova and Juho Pojonen. Audio Notes are a copyright production of Music at Menlo.